To do that, don't have any users assigned to groups other than staff. Every single user, to include your admins, have just a regular staff user group. Then you want to choose a strong group password for, let's say we're going to have the admins group in this case. You want to choose a strong password for that group. Change the easiest way to actually set that password is to change the password on a normally locked account. I like to use LP. To do that, just obviously password LP, put the password in, and then that's the slide that I lost. Then what you do is you actually cut and paste that out, edit the Etsy groups file, and replace the no password in the Etsy groups file with that password. Then whenever someone wants to actually change to that group, they just issue a new group command, new group admins, for instance. It will then prompt them for the password. They put the password in, and they are then part of that admins group. If they do not have the correct password, they cannot change groups. Obviously, also, you'll probably want to go back and relock the LP account when you're done. I like to restrict the use of SU. I'm kind of a jerk when it comes to getting root access. I like to make it as difficult as possible, even for people that are supposed to have it. If you want to actually get UID 0 on one of my machines, you're going to have to provide me with about 8 strong passwords before you're done. One of those ways is by restricting the use of the SU. There's our admins group. Assign a password to that group, which we talked about. Then change your permissions on the group. And anyone who wants to then SU has to new group first to the admins group, and then they will be allowed to SU. Lock the system accounts. This one, I'm not quite sure why so many of these accounts are unlocked by default with Solaris. Make sure to lock the daemon, the LP, the bin, the sys, the ADM, the UCP, blah, 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 blah. Lock them all so that they look like that. Also, lock the sysadmin and sys groups in the Etsy group file. Same process. Next, you want to edit the Etsy default password to require a password change at least every 8 weeks with a 1 week interval between password changes. Also, in that file, you can set your minimum character length for passwords. Properly configured, you're going to look something like that, where you have a max weeks of 8, min weeks of 1, and the password length. 8, 9, 10, whatever you want to use there, at least 8 for the password length. One thing, if the password is already enabled, it is not going to do anything until they have to change. In other words, if you've got some guy who's got, you know, his username, it's 3 characters for his password as well, until 8 weeks have passed and he has to change his password, that password is still going to be sitting there. Run PW check to check for inconsistencies. What that will do is it will check the field number, the login name, the UID, the GID, and the login directory and shell for the user. Verify that those are correct. Do the same thing with the group. Run group check to make sure that those are properly configured and what you are expecting to see. Then you're also going to want to verify that the permissions of Etsy group are 644. Log all SU attempts. Some people have this set so that they're not all logged, that only the failed SUs are logged. I like to log them all. I want to know everyone that tried and everyone that succeeded to get SU. Disk space can be an issue if you don't check this and clear it out every once in a while. First of all, to do that, you just verify that Etsy default SU exists and provides a path to the SU log. It'll look something like that. Then you also want to log the failed login attempts to the login log. You have to actually create that file. It is not created by default. on a very large network where you have a whole lot of users that are going to be logging in on a regular basis, this may not be feasible because you don't need to necessarily know every single login. It'll just take up too much space, and it's going to be something that you're never actually going to go through and look at anyway. But if you're in a small environment where you have only a few users, it's a good idea to actually see when and where and how they logged in. To do that, after you touch it, you change the ownership over to root and the sys group, and you change the permissions to root only. Failed login attempts are going to look like this. Haxor did not get in. What that tells us is the time that he attempted to log in and failed, and where he tried to log in from. You want to turn on INET deconnection tracing, and what that will do is attempt to trace all incoming TCP services, and that will log in syslog. To do that, you just edit the init.d INET services file and add a minus T to the INET.d start line. So it will look like that. Then you're going to want to kill and reboot the INET daemon because it is not currently running with tracing on. This is assuming, of course, a live system that's not going to be rebooted before you put it on the network. Just kill it, restart it with the minus T switch. You want to, this is one of those things I was talking about before where if you're in an operational environment, this is can be very dangerous. You want to configure the Etsy system to prevent stack-based buffer overflow attacks. Prevent is probably a little bit strong of a word there. Maybe help prevent is better. To do that, you edit the Etsy system and set the no exec user stack to 1 and also the no exec user stack log to 1. What that will do is any attempts to execute code on the program stack will be logged to syslog. What I would do if you are in an operational environment is I would set the log to 1 and not actually set the no exec user stack. I say that because especially with some legacy third-party software, they are programmed to intentionally run code on the stack. If you have, I believe Oracle 7 is actually one of those. So if you have Oracle 7 running on your machine, it will kill it and it will not work anymore. But if you log it for a couple of weeks, a month of normal environment time, then see if anything actually showed up in the log. If it did not, you're probably in good shape and you can go ahead and do this. If it did, then you know that you need to probably either upgrade that piece of software, or if that's not going to happen, you don't want to do this. Next, you need to check your cron and at jobs for validity. Pretty much just look at them, make sure that what you expected to be there is what is there. Place the user IDs of the users that are allowed to create cron jobs in the cron.allow file. Place the user IDs of the people that are allowed to create at jobs in the at.allow file. Conversely, you want to make sure that people that are specifically not allowed are in the cron.deny. I say that because the cron.allow is your default. That is what it's going to use. However, if for some reason that is bypassed and fails, the cron.deny will at least users that you know on the system that you absolutely do not want making creating cron and at jobs, it will fail over to there, and if they are in there, they will. You'll have a second secondary measure to make sure that they are not allowed to create the job. It's also important to verify that cron jobs are legit, both before and after adding a user to cron.deny. That's because it only disallows users from creating future jobs. If they already have the job scheduled with cron or at, it will continue to run. You need to ensure that the scripts and programs that are launched by cron and at are readable only by the owner. You don't want anybody and their brother to be able to take a look at these. An example of that is if mailrun.pl is scheduled to run in the cron tab, it should look like that. I'm the only person that has access to it. I'm the only person that can modify it. I'm the only person that can look at it. to the if you must uses. FTP, disable it. Use SFTP instead. If you have to use it, enable logging and debugging by editing the inetd.conf and adding the minus DL switches. Properly logging. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Properly logging entry in inetd.conf is going to look like that. Just at the end, you have the minus DL. You also want to make sure that at a minimum, root UUCP bin and anonymous are in the etc FTP users file. The etc FTP users file is the file that says who cannot use FTP, who cannot FTP into your system. At a minimum, those need to be in there. You want to configure the etc default FTPD to remove the OS banner. You know, whenever you log into Solaris, it'll come back and it'll say SunOS 5. Whatever. You want to get rid of that. You don't want to give them any extra. I mean, there's enough programs and tools out there that will tell them what operating system you're running. Don't just freely give them the information and cut half the time out of their work. Also, if they're actually having to use Nmap or whatever, you're going to be getting something in your log somewhere along the line to let you know that you've been scanned, that you or whatever. If they are able to just FTP to you and it tells them what version you're running, you've cut a lot of their work off. To do that, you just echo banner with null. That's open and close quotes into the etc default FTPD. That will, when they log in at that point, it will then have no login banner. No OS banner, I should say. Telnet banner is essentially the same thing. Edit the etc issue to issue a warning banner. First of all, you're going to have to create that file. It is not created by default. And then just, again, put something in there. Unauthorized access. You're going to die if you come in. Whatever. I don't care. Just something that tells them, I don't want you here if you're not supposed to be here. The only reason you're doing that, I mean, it's not like Joe Leet guy is going to come in and say, oh, well, I'm sorry. I'm not authorized access. I better log off. But what it will do is, if you have a properly authorized by your legal department etc issue and a warning banner, when it comes time for prosecution, you can take that to court and say, we told them don't come here. They came anyway, and we want them to pay. Configure the default telnet D to remove the OS banner. That is the exact same process as the FTP banner. And it will just get rid of the OS version when somebody logs in. The NDDs, are most of you guys familiar with the NDDs? I like to use them. They allow you to do quite a few things that otherwise you don't really realize are running, because nowhere does it say, oh, I have IP source routing enabled. There's no script that you can run through and find that where that is. But you can actually sit here with the NDDs and disable that stuff. First thing I'd like to do is get rid of the IP forwarding and directed broadcast. To do that, you just do an NDD-set /dev/IP_forwarding, set it to 0, and hit enter. Same thing for forward directed broadcast. If you do a -get instead of a -set, it'll tell you what it is currently set to. You want to configure the system to ignore redirects and disable the forward source routing. Ignore redirects you want to set to 1. Forward source routed you want to set to 0 to disable. You also want to configure the system to not respond to address mask broadcast, echo broadcast, timestamp, and timestamp broadcast. Set all of those to 0 with your NDDs. Also, while I'm thinking about it, there's not just dev IP. You have UDP, you have TCP specific. You can go through and look at them and see what exactly you do need, what exactly you don't need, and there is a lot that you can disable there, a lot of enumeration info that will come back to haunt you later that you can stop right there at the OS level and not have to rely on your border devices. All right, now here comes what I was talking about before about making it very, very difficult A lot of people do not like to do this because it becomes very hard for your admins as well as everyone else to gain root access to the box. What I like to do is totally disable root login from everything. Root can never log in, period. The only way that you can get UID 0 is to log in at this point. If we do this, they have to know the open boot banner to get the machine up. Then they have to have a regular user account and password so that they can log in. Next, if they want to ask you to root, they are going to have the admin's group password so that they can get in, and finally they're going to actually have to know the root password so they can ask you. If they can get through all that and own you, you deserve to be owned because you have crappy passwords. To do that, console only access. You edit the console setting in the Etsy default login to dev console. That way, root can't come in any other way. Can't SSH, can't telnet, can't FTP, but it can still come in as a norm, as a console user sitting at the box. Like I said, I like to go a step farther and disable it completely and just set it to dev null. TCP sequence prediction. Do any of you guys use ISS? Yeah, ISS sucks with TCP sequence prediction. It shows up every time, no matter what version of what software you're running. Everything apparently has a TCP predictable sequence, and that's because they set it to, like, if it guesses one out of 500,000 correctly, then it's predictable. But you can actually, with Solaris 8, you can take care of that problem, even for ISS's toughness. To set the TCP strong ISS to 2 in the Etsy default INET init, it is by default set to 1. Next, you want to edit the Etsy profile and set the U limit to 0 to restrict the generation of core files. It doesn't always work, but it's worth a try. Here's another one that can be kind of dangerous. Randomizing the file system inode numbers with the FSI RAN. Tells you why, but again, very dangerous. You have to unmount the file system before FSI RAN can be run. And you want to make sure that you have backed them up before you do it, and you've checked the file system on them, because the chances of it actually ruining your file system inodes are just as good as it working. So that's one that you're going to kind of take with a grain of salt. If it works and you've got a system in place where you can actually do it on a regular basis, it's great. If you actually have a problem where you have an operational system that cannot go down for any length of time, I would actually skip this step. Tripwire and log check. Install and configure those to monitor for file system integrity. Install Snort, any other intrusion detection that you IDS that you have at your disposal. I like Snort. It's free. It works. It's just what I prefer. If you want to use Real Secure or something else, go for it. You want, but there are freeware IDS products out there that you can that you have access to, so you really don't have an excuse for not having some intrusion detection sitting on your servers. At the border, you are going to want to stop all UDP port 113 and TCP port 113 traffic inbound. Also, you want to block ICMP type 17, that's your mask request traffic at the border. And finally, allow access to through the firewall only to necessary ports on specific machines. In other words, if you have a web server, a mail server, and a DNS server sitting behind your firewall, what you want to do is allow port 25 traffic only inbound to the mail server, not port 25 traffic across the board. Same thing would go for HTTP and port 80 and port 53. Specifically to that box, that way that if you for some reason skip a step, miss a step, or somebody accidentally re-enables a service on one of those machines, you have another layer of protection to keep somebody from making access to your machine on that port. implementing the stuff that we talked about here today is not going to make you totally secure. We were talking about it the other day, and I've yet to find the actually totally 100% secure you know it box. It cannot be made. If there is a determined attacker out there and you are his target and he is knowledgeable, he is probably going to get you. But what you can do by doing this is take the time to reduce your script kiddie threat to essentially nothing. You'll also be able to, if you have an attacker that is looking for a target of convenience, you are not convenient. It's like the club. Car thieves can get the club off of your car very quickly. However, when they walk by and they see two sitting next to each other, one has the club, one doesn't, they steal the car without. Unless it sucks. Finally, also patches. One of the biggest problems that I see, and I mentioned it before, is people not applying the patches. If you maintain patch level, you will reduce the bulk of your problems. Just by maintaining patch level and disabling unneeded services, you've probably reduced your risk by about 90%. I have a few references in here. Some of them are online, some are books. Solaris Security by Peter H. Gregory. Sun Press actually puts that out. It is a very good book. A lot of the info that came from this can be found in that book. Unfortunately, it is Solaris 7 specific, so that's why I had to update quite a few of the things from his book. The other thing that I wanted to do was show you. The results of the ISS scans. Like I said, that is the initial scan with essentially a default install, a dummy install. If you run through this process and do all the steps, when you are done, you will have not that. This. You will have four loads remaining, traceroute, ICMP netmask, ICMP timestamp, all of which should be blocked at your border, and OpenSSH running, which is more of an informational item to let you know that you have it. There is not a vulnerability actually associated with that, assuming that you have your OpenSSH at the current patch level. I had hoped to actually get this presentation updated for Solaris 9. Unfortunately, I have a multiprocessor system, so I had to buy the software, and I didn't get it in time to update the slides, but I did get it in and get it installed. I ran through the process on Solaris 9 with actually better results because there is no OpenSSH. It comes bundled with SSH now. However, I haven't tested everything to actually make sure that I'm not breaking anything. So before you do this on Solaris 9, you're going to want to do it in a non-operational environment and verify that none of the steps are going to break your system. I have time. That is it. I have time for about three questions because I have to go to the war driving contest right from here. So, if you want to come up, if people that want to ask questions, if you come up and use the mic so everybody can hear. Yeah, just had a question about the slides, if people don't have them. They will be posted on the DEF CON site eventually, but if you want them before that, you can go to www.securitytribe.com, and I will have a link off of there to the slides so that everybody can get a copy of them.
Hi. Weetzie Venema used to have software that would help protect RPC services, like RPC bind and stuff. I don't know if they still work for Solaris 8 or are there any other. You could also use it in combination with TCP wrappers to help wrapperize and protect your RPC services. Is anything recommended for Solaris 8 or 9 in that manner?
Unfortunately, I don't really have a very good answer for you. I don't know.
Explain your pros and cons of using sudo instead of su.
Actually, sudo I have absolutely no problem with. It essentially is doing the same thing that I'm doing with the lockdown with the groups. And thank you very much because I meant to mention that. It is if you want to make it a little bit easier on your admins, that is a definite way to do it. And I don't see any problem with doing it that way.